Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great day today, whether you're listening live here Saturday afternoon on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620, or you're listening to the podcast version of this show whenever you like, wherever you like, however you get your podcasts. We are always here to bring you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture, hopefully make your day just a little bit better. Joining me to do so is my co-host, Jeremy Branch. Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. I know that award season is kind of underway, so we're going to jump into a little bit of that. And we got some big Star Wars stuff to discuss as well. So y'all stick around.
Yeah, the big news is that I have been hired to play Han Solo's grandson. No, I'm just kidding. nobody wants to see any of that. Nobody wants to see Han Solo's grandson. Nobody wants to see me in a Star Wars. Well, maybe they want to see me in a Star Wars movie, but certainly not playing Han Solo's grandson.
I'd be here for it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's not nobody. It's an audience of one. So I got that going for me, which is nice. So, you know, the Dalai Lama, 13th Lama. I'm going off into Caddy Shack territory. It's too easy to do. Speaking of films that never won awards, that maybe should have. We had the Golden Globes this past Sunday night. We had the Critics' Choice the week before that. A lot of the nominations for the various Guild Awards have started to come out. The Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild, I believe the Producers Guild dropped their nominations, et cetera, et cetera. So we're starting to see the Oscar race somewhat come into focus a little bit. There's, of course, always some question marks because, you know, the various groups and guilds and all that, their nominations don't necessarily line up one-to-one. A lot of people tend to look at the Golden Globes in particular as a bellwether, which I've always...
Well, I mean, it's your favorite of the shows.
I mean, I enjoy the show, usually. And honestly, I did not get to watch it this year, but usually I do enjoy the show. I think the award is still, even though it's been reformed a bit over the past few years, is still arguably fairly meaningless.
Yeah.
And here's the reason I don't necessarily buy into the Globes as a predictor of the Oscars. One, you're talking about two very different groups that present these awards. The Globes.
So it used to be the Hollywood Foreign Press, but who does the Globes now?
It's still basically, it's not, that organization does not exist anymore, but it is still awarded by a voting body that is made up of journalists who mostly write for foreign outlets.
So it's basically the same thing with a new.
Sort of. I mean, it doesn't have the corruption of the Hollywood Foreign Press behind it because the Hollywood Foreign Press was a very corrupt organization. There are millions of examples of how corrupt that organization was that you can point to. Name 100. Okay. Well, that's the show today, folks. We could start with Pia Zadora winning one as a best newcomer or something like that, that her rich husband bought for her.
Corrupt.
Yeah. Little things like that. Anyway. So there's that. So that would be the voting body for the Globes, whether you think that's legitimate or not, whatever. You know, any group of people can decide this is what we like and this is the award. That's fine. Critics' Choice is an award presented by critics also. You know, they're not necessarily foreign critics writing for foreign outlets, but they are critics, you know, in broadcast and print journalism who are choosing what they think are the best movies of the year. And the best TV series.
You know, to me, that's one of the most respectable of all of them.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree. So you contrast that with the guilds. Screen Actors Guild is actors voting for actors. Mm-hmm. Directors Guild is directors voting for directors. When you look at the Oscars, the way that body of folks is put together is it is kind of like the Guild Awards. You have actors nominating actors and directors nominating directors, et cetera, down the line. And so in order to get onto the ballot, you have to win the favor of your particular field.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the ballot is done, the voting is the entire body of the awards of the Academy. But the Academy is entirely made up of people that work in the motion picture industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's directors, actors, producers, you know, hair and makeup, special effects, audio, music, you know, every branch that there's an award for, there are professionals that work in that portion of the film industry that are members of the Academy Awards.
That's why I always feel it's the most self-congratulatory of all of them. However, it is also the one that seems to be the most highly revered or respected of all of them.
I would agree. That's one of the reasons that I don't necessarily look at the Globes as a bellwether. I think what the Globes and some of these other shows do is they bring things to people's attention to make them realize, hey, I need to see that if I want to be in the conversation. That's not only true of those of us who are just fans watching, it's true of the people that vote for the Oscars too. They realize, hey, oh yeah, I haven't seen Sentimental Value yet. I need to make sure I watch that before I vote. I haven't seen.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing until a couple of days ago.
Yeah, or I haven't. You know, you name it. Any of the films that are in the conversation. You know, oh yeah, I got to put that on my list to make sure I watch that before we vote, before we do the nomination. Mm-hmm. So they're great at raising awareness. The other reason I don't think the Globes are a great bellwether is because they get a little bit more credit for being prognosticators than they should get. Because they divide comedy and musical and drama into separate categories. So
that's
they present
a really good point.
They present two awards for best film, two awards for best actor, two awards for best actress. So they've got double the chance of being right as a predictor.
That's valid. I'm looking at one battle after another as being the clear front runner for the Golden Globes, and I'm wondering if you think that kind of makes it a lock in the Oscars.
I wouldn't say it's a lock, but I would say that it has certainly been the favorite going into this. It won the Critics' Choice as well, and you know, it has been certainly a critical darling. I think a lot of people are going to really like it. I don't know if it's going to necessarily take home all the awards, but I think it's probably a favorite for Best Picture, maybe for Best Director, and maybe for Screenplay. And that's one place that the Globes do differ from the Academy Awards as well. While they give out the Academy Awards has separate awards for adapted screenplay and original screenplay. The Globes just gives out one award for screenplay. They gave it to One Battle After Another, which could very well win adapted screenplay at the Oscars, but it can't win original screenplay because it is an adaptation. So that does open the door for something else like maybe Ryan Coogler for Sinners to win that award.
Well, and you and I are such big fans of Sinners. What do you think about this cinematic and box office achievement award that Golden Globes has been doing lately?
I hate it. I think it's a consolation prize for them to give a prize to a movie that was popular. And it doesn't really matter if the movie deserved to win another award or not. And I think that may be why it didn't win Best Drama. Because
it's
they knew
tough
they could
to put
because
that one into Best Drama, yet they put One Battle After Another into comedy or musical. So it's like you can kind of just put it wherever you want.
Well, One Battle After Another is pretty satirical.
I would argue satire is different, but I agree.
I'll be honest with you. That was my first reaction when the nominations came out as well. But the more I thought about it and in conversation with some friends about it, I came around to the fact that yeah, this does kind of belong under comedy. It is a funny movie. But it is very much, it's a satire. It doesn't seem like a ha-ha funny movie, although I definitely laughed a lot in watching it.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I kind of came around to that. You could easily make the argument that Sinners is a musical.
You could. That's a good point.
Yeah, but I do think it is probably more of a drama than it is a musical. I think that voters for the Golden Globes knew that they could give it that other, you know, made up award, and that maybe led more people to give that one to Hamnet and feeling like they could spread things around. So I don't know how this is going to affect things in the long run. We've got a few weeks. The Academy Award nominations are getting ready to drop, I believe, this week. So we'll see how it goes. We've got to take a break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line with and yes, we're going back to the 70s, guys. Are you excited?
Yes, we are.
Are you excited, Jeremy?
We're going back to the 70s in more than one way, and this will come up in the conversation.
You got your
we'll get to it. Your
bell bottom trousers and your what else? What are the big fashions of the late 70s?
Butterfly collars.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Some get some grow some mutton chops out maybe.
Yeah, got to have mutton chops.
We're going to talk about Star Wars because there's big Star Wars news going on right now. Big Lucasfilm news, I guess I should say more accurately. There's only so much Star Wars music. So, we've played a lot of it in times that we've talked about Star Wars in the past. So I don't think we'd ever played the disco version of the Star Wars theme by Miko before. Seemed like what the heck. But, I was listening to that and I was thinking, oh, yeah, this is what James Gunn was parodying with the Guardian song with Hasselhoff on the vocals. I knew it at the time, but like it's like, oh yeah, this really does sound a lot like that, doesn't it? I digress. As I mentioned, big news in the big disturbance in the force this week, let's put it that way.
It is,
and that is that we have new power in the galaxy. The Kathleen Kennedy has announced that she is stepping down as the head of Lucasfilm after something like 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the entirety of the Disney era, although she actually came on as the head of Lucasfilm shortly before Disney bought Lucasfilm. George Lucas actually hired her for the job.
She was part of the deal, right?
Yeah, she was. She's stepping down, which is not a huge surprise. She is in her 70s. She has, made allusions over the last few years that she'd be stepping down and had been thinking about a succession plan and that sort of thing. But this week she has announced that the time has come. And I don't think it's necessarily a huge surprise, at least in part, as to who the reins of Lucasfilm are going to. I think if you've paid attention to Star Wars over the last, let's say, what do you think, 5 years? Is that
sure, give or take a little bit, even more.
That about right? It shouldn't be a surprise that on the creative side, Dave Filoni, who came into Star Wars working on the Clone Wars animated series, working with George Lucas, probably one of the world's foremost Star Wars experts, the guy who created the character of Ahsoka Tano and has been a driving creative force behind a lot of Star Wars stuff over the past several years, a lot of the animation, but it has really veered into the live action stuff in the last few years as well. Very heavily involved in The Mandalorian, obviously the Ahsoka series, et cetera. Dave Filoni, who's actually been Lucas's chief creative officer for a while now, will now be the co-head of the studio. And it's kind of a James Gunn, Peter Safran, DC situation where James Gunn is the creative head and then Peter Safran is the business head and they work together.
Sure.
Similar situation here at Lucasfilm. The business side will be headed up by Lynwen Brennan. She's been an executive vice president and general manager at Lucasfilm. She came into that position after 16 years at Industrial Light and Magic, which is also a Lucasfilm company.
Oh, wow.
So, somebody who's been very heavily involved with the company on the business side for some time now. So,
interestingly, I'd never heard her name leading up to this.
Yeah. I think that you could say the same thing about Peter Safran on the DC side when we're talking about that setup over there. I mean, Safran was known as a producer, but again, really is more the biz guy.
Sure.
So I think that relationship seems to be working well at DC so far. So there's some questions as to whether how it will work out at Lucasfilm. But I think where we need to start this discussion is kind of looking at how we got to where we are.
Yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit about Kathleen Kennedy's legacy.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Kathleen Kennedy before she came into Lucasfilm first. This is somebody that, at least on the surface, it's hard to think of a better person to bring in to run a company like Lucasfilm than somebody with the track record that Kathleen Kennedy has. Kathleen Kennedy's first two producing credits were for Poltergeist and E.T.
I've heard of those.
Yeah, you know, little things like that. She, you know, was very heavily involved with Spielberg. She was also a producer on Schindler's List, Munich, his version of War of the Worlds, Lincoln, Jurassic Park, the Indiana Jones films, which are part of Lucasfilm. She's in charge of that too, which means that Filoni and Lenwin are now in charge of Indiana Jones as well as Star Wars, and they're in charge of Willow. And, you know, Lucasfilm is more than just Star Wars. It's just that Star Wars is the lion's share of what Lucasfilm is. You know, other than those, you know, some of the films that she's involved with range from The Sixth Sense to Back to the Future to The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. You know, so incredible producing track record before she even came into Lucasfilm. You know, find me a producer that has a better track record than that.
No, I can't think of too many. And the truth is, while I do think there were some missteps in the handling of the Star Wars universe, I think that Kathleen Kennedy heralded some really great stuff, including some of my favorites in the canon of Star Wars.
Well, so talk to me about that.
People really like to use her as a punching bag, but that doesn't resonate with me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's easy to go after the figurehead at the top. When you got to remember that Lucasfilm is still a subsidiary of Disney. She may be at the head of Lucasfilm, but when currently it's Bob Iger says, no, we're doing this. Guess what? We're doing this.
Your hands are tied. Yeah.
And I mean, that is where I think you can point at some of the things that some people have considered flaws during Kathleen Kennedy's tenure at Lucasfilm can really be pointed at elsewhere. And I'm thinking about,
I think Filoni is some of the weaker spots in the Disney era.
Okay, interesting. Well, we'll come into the Filoni of it all in a little bit here.
Yeah.
But you said that you thought Kathleen Kennedy was responsible for some of your favorite things. Hit me with what those are.
I mean, I think The Force Awakens is incredible. I think this new era of characters are iconic. I love the redesign of the kind of stormtrooper characters. I think so much of what she did to kind of reinvigorate, and I mean her and the creative team, so much of what they did is instantly iconic and resonates with a whole lot of people. Andor is probably my favorite of all Star Wars, and it kind of follows on the heels of Rogue One, which I also thought was a really sophisticated storytelling about the rebellion, and Andor kind of carried the torch forward with that. And I can't think of too much Star Wars prior to that had so much thematic weight.
Well, and you know, it's on record that Tony Gilroy was not really interested in being involved in Star Wars. Kathleen Kennedy went after him, and she recruited him, and she brought him on board, and he came up with things that he thought he was never going to get away with, and Kathleen Kennedy pushed him to go further with.
And that's awesome. Why
we have Rogue One in the vision and the way that it is seen, because there was some behind the scenes drama on Rogue One. We know there were a lot of reshoots, etc., but I think nobody can really argue with the finished product. And then Andor is, you know, one of the greatest pieces of science fiction of the last 30 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, that doesn't happen without Kathleen Kennedy. So it's one of those things where, yeah, maybe you can knock her for some things, but I think that you got to consider outside forces too. Mm-hmm. There were outside forces involved in shifting gears away from what was done with The Last Jedi, which I actually think The Last Jedi pretty damn great. I know not a lot.
It's awesome.
I know not everybody agrees with me, but Rian Johnson was taking the story in new directions, and because of a few very vocal loudmouths, they got scared and backed off of that. And we ended up with Rise of Skywalker, which I don't think is a bad movie. There are plenty of people that disagree with me about that.
Mm-hmm. I'm one of them.
But it didn't fulfill the promise of The Last Jedi. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
And, I think the same with the overload on TV series. That was something that came mm-hmm. from above at Disney that, hey, we got to feed the streaming beast. That was when Bob Paycheck or Bob, whatever his real name is, but Bob Paycheck is what we can call him, was in charge, and he did the same thing to Marvel and dragged Marvel down. You know, so we can look at the Disney TV track record the last few years and see, okay, well, you know, they didn't give The Acolyte a second season, and they didn't give, you know, all these various other shows a second season. And maybe they made an Obi-Wan series when they should have made an Obi-Wan movie, and, you know, things like that. But those were decisions that were being handled above Kathleen Kennedy's pay grade.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. I just now read this the other day, and I'm glad they're not messing with the Orlando parks, but apparently they're going into Disneyland and removing all of the Disney era characters in favor of returning to the 1970s. So to me, it feels like they are, I hate to say it, but almost ashamed of Kathleen Kennedy's legacy.
Well, I'm not sure it's that, but let's talk about that some more when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Come on out in the sun now. Come on out and have fun now. Fly over to a place in space so far, far away. Good times have begun now. It's like the castle run now. Fly over in a ship to a hip galactic party. Just chill and take a nap now, or grill a Ronda rap now. You're finally free, you see, to dance through the night. Come on out to the beach here, there's no empire's reach here. Whatever you do, it's true, we're set to ignite.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. My co-host, Jeremy Branch, is on the line with us. Scarif Beach Party. Isn't that where they were at the end of Rogue One?
I had never heard that song before. That's true.
Am I misremembering? Is that not the planet?
That's correct.
Okay. That was not the most beach party of moments.
No.
But that is Weird Al Yankovic. Maybe not a lot of people realize that Weird Al Yankovic actually did a third Star Wars song. That was done for Lego Star Wars Summer Vacation in 2022, so just a couple of years ago. We're talking about everything going on with Lucasfilm and Star Wars as Kathleen Kennedy, who has been the president of Lucasfilm for something like 14, 15 years now, announced this week that she is stepping down. We talked a little bit about some of the highs and lows of her term leading Lucasfilm. And, you know, we focused really on Star Wars. We should mention also, you know, there's a couple of Indiana Jones movies that came out in that time frame to varying levels of success. There was a Willow TV series that, you know, again, to we talked about it on this show.
Yeah, well, show it to me and I'll believe you.
Well, if you can find it, it's out there somewhere. It's not on Disney Plus anymore, but it is out there somewhere.
That's what they say.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the highs and lows. So we're going to move on into talking about the future here. And that is the new leadership at Lucasfilm. The chief creative officer is Dave Filoni, which shouldn't be that big a shift because he's been the chief creative officer for a little while now. But he's taking on some expanded roles with being the co-president of the company. You mentioned earlier, Jeremy, you had some reservations about that.
Yeah, I do. I'm not wild about a lot of what Filoni's done. Don't get me wrong. I did watch The Clone Wars, and I think there is some great stuff in it, and I think there is some not as good stuff in it. Ahsoka didn't light my world on fire, and I feel like Filoni is such a Star Wars geek that his sensibilities may not always mesh with the broader fandom and connect in a way that the mainline movies have.
So you think, if I could sum this up, and you tell me if I'm summing it up incorrectly, you think he's too into the lore and not mainstream enough for an audience outside the hardcores?
Yeah, you said it perfectly, and I know that that might sound counterintuitive, especially to fans. I just feel like he is so in love with the character Ahsoka that it has almost kind of kept him in that lane for a really long time. Like you said, about 5 years ago is when Filoni kind of started to look as if he was, stepping up his role at the studio. However, Clone Wars dates back to probably 15 years ago or something.
Yeah, it's pre-Disney.
He's been involved for a long time.
Pre-Disney, around the time of the prequel trilogy.
Yeah.
So, in fact, the initial Clone Wars miniseries came out while the prequel series was running. So.
Oh wow.
Yeah. They did those shorts, the little shorts that ran on Cartoon Network that Jendy Tartakovsky was working on.
Those were pretty cool, and I like Asajj Ventress. I think that's a cool character. Mm-hmm. I don't hate Ahsoka. I think she's cool as well. It just feels like a little too far removed from the stuff about Star Wars that people really love. However, I do think people like Mandalorian and Grogu quite a bit, and that's a kind of a, Favreau Filoni thing. So I don't know. I might be off base. What do you think about that?
I think you got a balance here. I think that you're absolutely right. People fell in love with The Mandalorian and Grogu. We're going to get a movie that coming up in a year or so that they have recently finished shooting. And that's something to keep in mind, too. The next two projects that are coming out, as far as in theaters, are both movies that Filoni has been somewhat involved with, but that Kathleen Kennedy was a producer on and has been involved with, too. So we've got The Mandalorian and Grogu, and then we've got this Star Wars Starfighter, I believe it's called, that Sean Levy is directing with Ryan Gosling starring.
It could be really good.
Yeah, so that literally just finished principal photography. So we've got those two movies coming up. I get what you're saying about Filoni. I think he is going to have to maybe adjust a little. I think live action has been a little bit of a learning curve for him, too.
Uh-huh.
But I think that he's got enough of it under his belt now that I'm not that worried about that. I don't think you're necessarily wrong about him leaning on Ahsoka a lot, but she's his creation.
Yeah, fair.
So, I get that, it's kind of like saying, oh, well, George R. R. Martin really leaned on Daenerys Targaryen and Jon Snow. Yeah.
Yeah, but to be fair, he created all of those characters.
True.
I guess what I'm curious about.
Not the best analogy, maybe I need to think about somebody in comics that brought a character into the Justice League that they created or something like that. That might be a better analogy.
Sure. Or whoever brought Nightwing into Batman or something like that.
Yeah. Anyway, so. I don't think your criticisms are necessarily unfair. I think that he knows that. And I think that while he's been building to some stuff and we're going to see that stuff continue to build, I think there's also so much of the Star Wars universe that's unexplored that he would like to explore that I don't think that's a permanent concern. I think we've been leading to something with these various series, Mandalorian, Book of Boba Fett, Ahsoka, that is leading to some sort of probably very different adaptation of the Timothy Zahn Heir to the Empire book series with Grand Admiral Thrawn being a central villain. I think that we're going to see some kind of movie or maybe even a movie trilogy based around that. Will obviously be very different than the books because the books also involved Luke and Han and all of those core characters that are not going to be part of this. But
do you think that's what people are excited about, or do we need to your point, pull from an era or something that audiences aren't familiar with and haven't seen yet, and almost another relaunch?
I think people can be excited about that if you do it the right way. I think that in the same way that we can make an argument that people are over Marvel, but everybody seems to think that Doomsday is going to bring everybody back into the fold. And it's kind of it's kind of a similar way to look at it, because if you think about it, this is kind of the Star Wars version of Avengers, of an Avengers movie, in that it's bringing together all of these characters from all of these various Star Wars properties.
Mm-hmm.
So could that work? Yeah. If it's done well and it's promoted right, absolutely could work. But, you know,
is there a world where those are the, exists moving forward?
I'm not sure, because this time period that those stories are taking place in is kind of between Jedi and Rise of Skywalker.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think they're still going to do projects that are set in other eras too. And I think that, you know, there was a Rey movie in the works. I think we very much could still see. I think we could see stuff in the Old Republic. We could see, you know, there's so many different ways they could go. The Star Wars universe encompasses such a wide range of times and eras that the possibilities are somewhat limitless.
Yeah.
And
my
I think
desire to see more Andor stuff, I think, is probably contrary to what people want to see, and that is Jedi, Sith, lightsabers, the stuff that we know and love. But I think there's a little bit of a stink on the sequel trilogy, which, again, I don't completely agree with. I didn't think Rise of Skywalker was great, but I think a lot of what was established there was really good.
Give it 10 years or so, and we'll start the revisionist takes on it. We'll start.
The
same way there's a whole generation that adores the prequels now. It's the way, you know, same thing happens in Star Trek. You know, oh, Voyager's terrible. Now, right now, everybody's like, oh, Voyager was great. Why don't people, you know, why doesn't Voyager get more attention? We're starting to see it with Enterprise. People hated Enterprise. That's part of it. That's absolutely part of it. There's the nostalgia factor creeps in, but there's also a critical reappraisal of things. And so I think that, given some time, I think that there's some argument made in there that they fumbled the ball by not following through on what Rian Johnson was doing.
Yeah.
But I also think that the way you fix that is the same way you fix the prequel trilogies, and it's with supplemental material. And Filoni is a big part of why the prequel trilogy has been kind of redeemed. It's because
that's
of the stuff
really
that,
good point,
that
and
he's
a lot of
built
that goes
off
to Clone Wars.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting. It's also going to be interesting to see what he does with Indiana Jones and Willow and some of these other properties. But it's hard not to focus on Star Wars when Star Wars is the 800-pound gorilla. We've got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. My co-host, Jeremy Branch, is on the line with me. And we're going to shift gears. We're going to talk about something that we've never, ever talked about on this show before, and that's a show called Stranger Things. Yeah,
Oh, brother, this guy stinks.
I'm kidding. obviously, we've talked about Stranger Things a lot lately, and if you're getting a little tired of it, I understand, but there's been some stuff in the last week that I wanted to jump on. And, you know, also we just talked about Sean Levy before the break, working on a Star Wars movie. Sean Levy, of course, being one of the big ups on Stranger Things, directed several episodes, was an executive producer, very instrumental in that show. So ties in as well. But, you know, we've talked off and on about how we're lacking a monoculture in this country and that we used to have back in the day, back in the day of the original Star Wars, where there were just things that, you know, there were so few entertainment options that everybody saw the same things and fell in love with the same things. And, you know, they just became omnipresent. You know, Star Wars is a great example of that, but things like network TV sitcoms and, you know, radio was much less diverse. So that, you know, everybody knew the pop hits, that sort of thing. And I think Stranger Things is as close as we can get to a monoculture in today's world, in that it is so big and so popular. And there are a few other things you could point at, like Taylor Swift and, you know, to an extent, Game of Thrones was a lot of people saw that as the last broadcast monoculture, cable monoculture, I guess I should say. Mm-hmm. But Stranger Things has such an influence and is so widely seen and widely thought of. The fact that we're, you know, now 17 days after the finale,
people are still talking about it.
There's still a lot of talk about it. There's still a lot of chatter about it online. And I think that the really interesting way that you can see the influence of this thing in a weird way is by looking at the pop music charts. You know, we saw this during season 4 when they used Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill, and the song came back onto the charts in a bigger way than in its initial release in the 80s. It was a top 40 hit back in the 80s, but it got into like the 30s. I think I want to say it peaked at like number 32 or something like that. Came back and was I think it got as far as number 3 on the US charts, at number 1 in some countries, at number 1 on Spotify. Big hit. We've seen that with a number of songs over the years. And there's been some interesting examples of that this week, as we've had, you know, a week and a half of Stranger Things season 2 being out, and for that to start affect the numbers on Spotify, the numbers on the various streaming services, and to some extent what's played on radio, which is what makes up the charts, as well as sales too. You know, so it's had an effect on sales as well. But interestingly, I think the biggest effect that we've seen, while we've seen some effects for things that were played in the last few episodes, the biggest effect is that song that we played coming in here. It's called End of the Beginning. And it's by an artist named Joe, DJO. Now, Joe is the musical name for none other than Steve Harrington himself, Joe Keery.
Yeah.
He's been doing this project for some time now. And in fact, that song is actually a few years old. It was originally released in 2022. Took off on the charts a couple of years later when it started getting picked up on TikTok. So initially charted in 2024 and did all right. Got as far as, I think, number 11 on the U.S. charts and had some success internationally, et cetera. With all the hype around Stranger Things coming back, it has recharted and is currently sitting at number 6 on the Billboard chart. So that's a new peak for that song. But it is also currently the number 1 song in the UK. It's the number 1 song on Billboard's global chart. It's the number 1 song on Spotify's charts in the US and globally. So it is, you know, taken Joe Keery and his guise as Joe to new heights. And I think that's directly attributable to all of the hype around the Stranger Things finale. And I don't think that's over yet. I think, you know, we could see this be a number 1 hit 4 years after its initial release.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting.
It's a great song too.
Yeah, no, I really like his music. I think he's a really interesting, performer from a musical scene. I think he's a great actor too, but I think he's a really interesting musical performer. And, you know, there's a lot of people involved in Stranger Things, by the way, who have musical backgrounds. You know, Maya Hawke has done an album. Several of the performers are Broadway veterans and have done stuff on Broadway. Finn Wolfhard's had a couple of different bands over the years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of musical talent in there. It's not just Dustin singing Never Ending Story, to speak of another song that got a big boost and big comeback from Stranger Things over the years. But we are also seeing this, this effect of it bringing songs from the 80s back onto the pop charts. Again, now that we're just a couple weeks out, the first charts that were affected by that came out middle of last week. No real surprise here. Prince's Purple Rain back in the top 40. Third time in the top 40. You had the initial release, and then it recharted after Prince passed. So currently sitting at number 27 on the U.S. Billboard chart. So again, the way that was used in the climax, I think we all kind of predicted that was going to happen. The interesting thing is going to see if it sticks around the way Running Up That Hill did, to where Running Up the Hill kind of became the song, one of the songs of that year in a lot of ways. And I'm not sure. I don't feel like I'm hearing Purple Rain everywhere the way I heard Running Up That Hill everywhere.
No, I think there was something genuinely special about the way they married the theme with the song, and the fact that it was so unfamiliar to your mainstream audiences that it was almost like the first time experiencing something, where Purple Rain is very heavily ingrained into this monoculture that we discussed.
Oh, I think that's absolutely valid. I think for a lot of people, Running Up That Hill was a new song.
Yeah.
I mean, the younger audience, obviously, but I think, you know, even given that it was not a massive hit in the U.S. when it was originally released, there's even a lot of people that were, you know, I don't think it got a lot of pop radio airplay. It did get some good MTV airplay. So maybe some people were familiar with it, but it wasn't one that, you know, had the omnipresence of a Purple Rain.
I'm a fairly big music guy, and it was my first time hearing it.
Okay, well, there you go. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So worth pointing out also that Running Up That Hill is back on the charts again with the finale of Stranger Things, and was at number 46 this week. So just outside the top 40, but maybe we see it climb back into the top 40. And then the other one that I thought was very interesting, charting at number 41 this week, so just barely missing the top 40, is a song that I don't think people realize was never a hit. So this is the first time it's been on the pop charts, and that's Landslide by Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so one of Fleetwood Mac's most famous songs, beyond a doubt, you know, it's a very beloved song, and it's been in a lot of things over the years. But it was when it was initially released back in the day, and this has been true up until maybe about 20 years ago now, used to be that if you were going to be on the pop charts, you had to have a commercially available single for purchase. So there's a few songs you can point out like that over the years. Madonna's Into the Groove is a big one. Song was everywhere, but it was not released as a physical single, so it didn't chart. Same thing with Landslide. Landslide was never a single, so it never charted. The rules have since changed, and now you don't have to have a physical single anymore. You can have downloads, you can have streams, all of these various ways. So for the first time ever, Landslide by Fleetwood Mac is a hit on the Hot 100 because of its use in Stranger Things.
That's awesome. I didn't realize
that.
Yeah,
and just like I said, just barely missed out on the top 40. And it's weird because I feel like it's not that prominent a song in the show.
Mm-mm.
It's definitely there. It's the lead in to the epilogue.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's not necessarily the song that I thought in watching the final season, oh, this is going to be the one that breaks out. Like, I thought Purple Rain, I'm surprised that When Doves Cry did not rechart, which again,
song.
We talked about this fairly recently on the show. They did fairly recently change the chart rules to where if you're going to rechart, you have to come in at higher than number 50. So I think, you know, it could have very well been number 51 for all we know.
I say to my point about Landslide and maybe why it ended up charting the way that it did is, again, thematic weight, the substance of the lyrics and the way that they correlate with the show about coming of age and the people all changing in the show. I feel like there's a sentimental thing attached to it that maybe, again, I didn't feel as much with the Prince. Like, I love the Prince needle drops, but to me, they just felt like, oh, look, they put Prince in Stranger Things, as opposed to like, oh, this really makes sense for what's happening in the story.
See, I felt Purple Rain really fit. And maybe that's why that's the one that charted and When Doves Cry didn't.
Yeah.
When Doves Cry was like, okay, here's the celebratory song, and that's fine. I could have seen other Prince songs they could have used in that moment, to be completely honest. They could have used Let's Go Crazy. They could
have, been a good one.
Even to just stay in the same album. But Purple Rain, that really spoke to that finale to me, to that climax. So I thought it really worked, even though it wasn't the song that I initially thought maybe they would use. I was kind of because there would have been the buzz out there about what's the song going to be. And I was thinking with it being 1987 and the Joshua Tree being so omnipresent, little U2, a little With or Without You.
Mm-hmm. That would have actually been good too.
Yeah. And would have fit too. But yeah, so, you know, Stranger Things still out there, still influencing everything that's going on. And don't forget, you can meet Cara Buono and Randy Havens from Stranger Things at Pensacon this year. We've got to go for today. We'll be back next week with more. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.